Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I grew up steeped in football. My father was involved in the amateur game, and with countless successfully scouted young men from the north having headed across the water in search of glory on the pitches of England and beyond, he knew all the movers and shakers. Remembering those renowned Irish players, many of whom passed through our house during my childhood, the names still trip off my tongue. Spurs captain Danny Blanchflower, also the man who allegedly quipped, "Not on your life," as he walked out of the This Is Your Life studio just before broadcast in February 1961, leaving a gobsmacked Eamon Andrews staring after him. Then there was Danny's brother Jackie, who suffered horrendous injuries in the Munich air crash and never played again. The inspirational Peter Docherty, who plied his playing trade at Manchester City and later managed Doncaster Rovers and Northern Ireland. Celtic captain Bertie Peacock, who retired back home when his playing days ended, opening a pub called Bertie's Bar in our hometown. And then, of course, there was legendary goalkeeper Harry Gregg, the hero of the Manchester United Munich air disaster in 1958. How he hated that hero label. Sorry, Harry. My father knew them all, but was especially close to Harry. As the person who gave Harry Gregg his start, yes, honestly, Harry even mentions it in his autobiography, all their lives they remained firm friends, right up to my father's death in 2015. 5 years later, Harry would follow my father to the graveyard in Coleraine, where, in a completely coincidental but beautiful twist of fate, the two old friends now lie toe to toe, their headstones facing each other across a narrow grassy swathe. Harry Gregg didn't do reverential, didn't bandy compliments about for the sake of it. When it came to the big man, you had to earn his respect. And he thought the world of Jim Lighton, my father. When my sister rang Harry to tell him of his death in August 2015 and to let him know the arrangements, Harry was succinct. "I'll be there at the grave," he said. "But you know me, I don't do churches." We did know. As a young man, Harry had great faith, but turned his back on religion after his 26-year-old wife Mavis died from cancer, just 4 years after Munich. When I left the doctor's room, after he told me there was no hope for Mavis, I thought to myself, well, if that's God, then you can keep him. Harry's precise words to me nearly 30 years ago. Imagine our surprise then, when in he walked to my father's funeral service. In his 80s, but still with that commanding presence of his, there he was, his back ramrod straight and his penetrating gaze surveying all before him. As I walked towards him, confused, he simply raised his hand in a gesture that told me there would be no discussion. "I'm here for Jim," were his only words, before he sat down quietly in one of the pews. Harry Gregg did things on his own terms. Yet despite his no-holds-barred approach to life, his hatred of fakery and plumoss, and his inability to offer claps on the back if none were due, he did have a few champions of his own. One was the aforementioned Peter Docherty. Another was George Best, the late, great George Best, who left the world 20 years ago. "Ah, bestie," Harry would say, unable to suppress a smile when the Belfast boy's name came up in conversation, both before and after his untimely death. And he'd reminisce about the pencil-thin lad with the breathtaking skills he first encountered back in the early 60s. There was something of the father and son about their relationship, Gregg being almost 14 years the elder. As a young apprentice at Old Trafford, George was often assigned to clean Harry's boots, and they built up a terrific rapport. But it grieved the older man greatly over the years to witness George's descent into the alcohol-fueled days that would eventually take his life. yet their admiration for each other never waned. Take a glimpse at the YouTube footage of the two of them sitting on the sofa together being interviewed by Noel Edmonds in 1984. Just look at how they greet each other when Harry walks onto the set. Notice the ease between them, the humour, the respect. And even as I look back now, these 20 years on, at the footage from George Best's funeral, at the thousands of sad faces along those Belfast streets, and at the cortege as it proceeds slowly up that long, long Stormont Avenue, I find myself searching among the gathered football royalty for the face of Harry Gregg. And there he is, dignified and desolate, in mourning for his lost boy. And as he stands there beside the coffin of the greatest footballer who ever left these shores, in my mind's eye, I imagine him glancing around and sighing in exasperation at some of the famous faces, at those that Harry considered the hangers-on, the kind of people who did his head in. But if I close my eyes, I can hear it now, that unmistakable, growly northern voice of his, as he puts his personal feelings aside and simply declares quietly to himself, "I'm here for Bestie." That's all I hear. In my imaginings, that's all he says. And that, to me, says it all.
This year marks the 150th anniversary of a forgotten piece of Dublin history. The story of the Great Liberties Whiskey Fire of 1875 has long fascinated me. I spent 32 years as a firefighter in Dublin Fire Brigade, 30 of those years in Dolphin's Barn Fire Station in the south inner city. This station covers the very area where that long ago fire occurred. On the evening of the 18th of June in the year 1875, the quiet of the city was disturbed by a massive fire in the bonded warehouse belonging to Lawrence Malone in RD Street in the Liberties. Malone's warehouse held freshly produced and maturing spirits in bond for Dublin's distilling giants like Powers, Rose, both Jemison's, Dublin Whiskey Distillery and the Greenmount Distillery, and many others, as well as other spirits kept in bond by city merchants. At least 1,800 barrels of whiskey in various stages of maturity, well over a quarter of a million litres, were stored there under the watchful eye of excise officers as the whiskey matured to a sellable and taxable state. The massive warehouse had been built in the hollow square formed by Cork Street, RD Street, Chamber Street and Ormond Street. It was surrounded by a shell of buildings which reflected the status of the area, tenements, tanneries, stables, a malt house, and numerous small yards where animals were kept by local people to supplement their meagre incomes by selling them to the slaughterhouses and butchers in the locality. The first indication of anything amiss came when the roof of Malone's caved in from the fire within, and blue flames shot up to 80 and 100 feet above the blazing inferno that the warehouse soon became. The flames were fed by huge quantities of alcohol bursting from the burning and exploding barrels, and with the roof gone, they also had access to unlimited oxygen to feed the conflagration which was developing as burning spirits flowed from the building, setting fire to all in its path. It was the worst combination of two disasters, a major fire and also a flood, as the burning liquid simply followed the path of the narrow and winding Liberty streets and flowed into Chamber Street, Ormond Street and on into Mill Street, burning all it touched. Into this hellscape of burning streets came Dublin Fire Brigade, under the command of the man who had led the brigade since it was founded in 1862, James Robert Ingram. Captain Ingram had, in his younger days, lived in New York City, where he was a volunteer firefighter with the Niagara Hose Company in Lower Manhattan. As Ingram would prove that night, facing a massive conflagration which would have tested any brigade in Europe, and with a total brigade strength of just 25 men, his Dublin Fire Brigade was the equal of any. He quickly ordered the shores to be blocked as burning liquid was entering them and making its way to the underground River Poddle and through the sewers, setting off explosions of sewer gas underground. Faced with the need to slow the flow of burning liquid and allow the alcohol to burn off, he had a plan. He ordered the corporation workmen, who daily cleaned the vast amounts of horse manure off the streets of the city, to reverse the process and bring all the manure they could find to the Liberties. There he had soldiers, large numbers of whom had been requested to assist with crowd control and firefighting, issued with shovels. They set to work to build dams of horse manure across the narrow streets to slow the flow and allow the alcohol to burn off like brandy on a Christmas pudding. As the barricades of manure and other waste were built, they slowed the flow of burning spirits. By 1:30 in the morning, Ingram and his men had stopped the spread of fire and could concentrate on saving what property they could. From the very early stages of the disaster, crowds had poured into the area to witness the fire and drink what they could from the streams of whiskey. Many would die there. Estimates ranged from 13 to 15. But no one was killed by the fire. Those unfortunate souls lost their lives to alcohol poisoning from drinking the filthy mess in the gutters. A sad and largely forgotten postscript to an otherwise heroic event.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you.
I
walked out this morning.
I was reading Patrick Kavanagh's beautiful poem, Advent, recently, savouring phrases like, "We have tested and tasted too much, lover. Through a chink too wide, there comes in no wonder." And it made me think about how fewer and fewer of us practice Advent-like abstinence anymore. Not us, not humans. We don't want to dial down our senses and rest through the darkest days of the year so that we might wake to the freshness of renewed daylight. Not us. The natural world does. The animal kingdom does. Most other animals slow themselves down and close their senses to the wintering world. Bears shut down their kidneys so they won't be disturbed by the need to urinate while they hibernate, week after week, till the long days of winter have passed. Squirrels, so busy gathering food for their caves and corners and fattening themselves up through the autumn, climb into bolt holes in ground and tree trunk, slow down their heartbeats to less than 4 beats a minute, cleanse their blood of impurities that might allow water in the blood to crystallize into ice, and surrender themselves to quietness and darkness, stirring only slightly to shiver their muscles into generating body heat if the temperature drops too far below freezing. When spring calls them back from their dreamless sleep, their breathing, heartbeat and temperature rise again as naturally as they fell at the onset of winter, and they and all other waking animals uncurl their bodies and blink their way into a dazzlingly bright, newly burgeoning world. Once upon a time, humans followed such patterns too, perhaps because we lived off the land and were governed by its rhythms, or perhaps because some otherworldly ritual encouraged us, even as we grew away from nature, to harmonize with the fadings and flourishings in the natural world. These days, it feels, we do precisely the opposite. We don't want hand, act, or part of the seeming dying that winter invokes. The darker the light, the more we strive to see. The leaner the world, the more we strive to acquire. The more silent the natural world makes itself, the more we clamour for noisiness, busyness and achievement. At this time of year, we turn up the volume and fill our eyes, hands and homes with things that sparkle and glitter, reflect and deflect. We tell ourselves and the world that we are alive, we will not be subdued, as if that were a singular truth. Last week, I saw a Christmas shop window full of gleaming things that sang out through a curtain of shimmering decoration, "See me, have me, I'm full of life." An iridescent orchestration of sparkling silver and glittering crystal. Cut glass champagne flutes toppled over and rolled into the stems of standing ones. Silver salvers and fat goblets caught and threw back chandelier shafts of light. I was reminded of the paintings of the Dutch Vanitas tradition. In the 17th century, the Dutch merchant fleet was the largest in the world. Goods were imported and exported through every season with a fulsome, fluid ease. Wealthy merchants and upper-class landowners had buying power to rival the church, and their patronage encouraged art guilds to produce sumptuous portraits of all the opulent things that populated their lives. Brimming rummers aglint in the candlelight, pewter and earthen plates crammed with fish, game and joints of ham, brass and glass jugs surrounded by fruit, flowers and heavy-handled silver cutlery. Musical instruments and instruments of science and learning, eyeglasses, watches, books, writing tools, all arranged on an overflowing table to reflect the might and magnificence of their owner, spellbindingly rendered in luminous layers of gleaming oil paint. Yet, when looked at more closely, almost unnoticed, the luxury goods were already beginning to spoil. The toppled glass lying on its side was drained of its contents. The softening, cut open pomegranates and lemons drooled juices that stained the linen cloths. And the guttering candles dripped streels of wax into their holders and were destined to burn themselves out. If those hints weren't enough, tucked half hidden amongst all the things might lie a human skull. The Vanitas painters knew that their patrons' to-ing and fro-ing and glittery getting was a kind of relentless self-deception that would eventually exhaust them. Bears and squirrels could have told them that too. They could have told them, and could tell us if we'd just listen, to take counsel from the slowdown of winter and surrender, even for a little while, to restraint, rest, and quiet, sweet renewal.
Veni, veni, Emmanuel, captivum solve Israel, qui genit in exilio, privatus Dei fili.
As a child, I was constantly cranshallying, which was what my father would accuse me of when I stayed up past my bedtime. It's really about doing everything you can and getting involved in things you don't need to be involved in to avoid going to bed. And I still do it as an adult. But what a descriptive word, cranshallying. I've no idea where it came from, nor did I ever hear it outside of our own house. I mean, even if I Google it now, it says, sorry, did you mean Strancally Castle in Waterford? Or did you mean Crash Holly? And I'm kind of thrilled that we used a word that even has the internet scratching its head. Our house was a place we'd often hear words like that. I remember hearing a conversation in the kitchen about a woman who was so overcome with grief at her husband's funeral that she had to be uxtered up the aisle. Your uxters being your underarms. Recently I found a book from 1880 entitled A Glossary of Words and Phrases Used in Antrim and Down, subtitled Words in Use Among the Low and Vulgar Only. Now many of these are Ulster Scots words and they're all familiar to me, which obviously makes me low and vulgar, but I'm okay with that. But they're brilliant words. I mean, if someone was grumpy, they would be described as carnaptious. A farl was a cake of bread. Too many farls and you might book or be sick. And 140 years on from that book, many of these words are alive and well and adaptable for the modern age. Indeed, a friend told me recently that her tolerance for drink was so low, she was known to her friends as Bookahontas. But other words from the book, although still part of a local secret code, haven't travelled as widely. Fornenst means instead of or opposite, as in the place you're looking for is just Fornenst the bank. Google knows that one, I've checked. But I realised that not everyone was familiar with it one day when four of us went to have a meal in a busy restaurant in West Tyrone. We ordered, and one friend from Bangor decided she'd like the gammon with pineapple. The owner was a Tyrone man who took the order, read it back to us at twice the speed, and went off to the kitchen. Came back 5 minutes later and revealed that there was no pineapple, but he did offer to replace it with something else. What he actually said was, "I had a wee look there and there's no pineapple, but what I'll do is I'll give you a wee bit of something Fornenst." Fornenst, in that case, meaning instead of. My friend didn't get that and asked loudly in a crisp North Down accent, "What is Fornenst? Is that some type of cheese?" As the sound of knives and forks and plates and chatter stopped entirely. One of my memories as a child is standing in Dunn Stores in Hill Street in Newry, and the local bread man, who was a good friend of my father's, bending down and saying to me, "Go and tell your da he's an old blether." I didn't know what a blether was, but it was a word my father used a lot about other people. A great word. Although I use it myself frequently, I recently looked it up to see where it came from. Defined as foolish or incoherent or nonsensical talk, and by extension, the person who does it, its first recorded use was by a Scottish poet called Alexander Scott in 1524. We've been blethering for 500 years. Blethering is my living, if I'm honest, and it's something I truly enjoy to the point where I've begun to feel confident enough to blether in another language. Walking through a forest on the coast of France on holidays, I saw a man hauling stuff out of a flatbed truck. There had been signs up about hunting, watch out for hunters, chasseur, and someone had said that there had been a sanglier, a wild boar had got loose the night before. And so, armed with those two words, a simple desire for a bit of conversation and a childlike optimism, I approached him. "Bonjour, how are you? You busy? You hunter and chasseur?" "Oui," says he. "Yeah, I saw the signs," I said. "Lots of sanglier." "This has gone great," I'm thinking to myself. "Oui," says he. "We got one last night." "Oh, and what do you shoot them with?" I asked. And he kind of looked at me, but I was in full blether at this stage. "Do you use a gun, un fusil, or a bow and arrow?" And from somewhere, I remembered the word for archery was tir à l'arc. And he just kind of smiled and shrugged and went back to his truck. I was a little disappointed how the conversation had petered out, really, given how well I'd been doing, and I walked on, head in the clouds, till the penny dropped. When I asked if he used bow and arrow, I didn't actually say tir à l'arc. I said arc en ciel. Somewhere, a hunter from the south of France is regaling friends with the story of this blether from Ireland who once asked him if he shot a wild boar with a rainbow.
Ooh. Kinsale, my late stepfather warned of the West Cork seaside town that became his retirement home, makes an old man young and a young man old. Visit, but do not live there. The young often do the opposite to what their elders advise, and so it was that from the age of 22, I spent the 90s and early noughties in Kinsale. Like most young people, I was feeling my way along. Rebellion without a roadmap, a kind of clueless self-confidence, an expectation of self-actualization, impatiently willing the dreams to land. There are libraries filled with what I did not know. And yet, counterintuitively, this kind of awkward youthful descent can fuel the minds of the greatest thinkers, a fuel that runs dry, mostly, by about the age of 40. Derek Mahon, the Belfast-born poet, was 34 in 1975 when he wrote his masterpiece, A Disused Shed in County Wexford, describing the entirety of the human condition poetically through the metaphor of a cluster of mushrooms growing in a dark, dank, derelict shed. Written with an Audenesque lyricism, the words are almost too beautiful to read. The stature of the poem became a yoke around Mahon's neck. That's the price of perfection. Mahon's vivid imagery often shimmers in acknowledgement to the observations of the Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein peaked at the age of 28, having published his masterpiece, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, in 1918, an attempt to describe the whole of the human condition, philosophically. Written in short propositions, Wittgenstein posits that we use language to describe our world pictorially. An almost perfect description of the poetic language of Mahon's Disused Shed. In 1981, Mahon wrote Tractatus, an unofficial ode to an unofficial mentor, sharing the same famous opening as Wittgenstein's Tractatus, "The world is everything that is the case." In the time I lived in Kinsale, I never met Derek Mahon, who had already lived there for many years when I arrived. He was famously private, not quite a recluse, but certainly very wary of the distraction of intrusion, especially from the literary world. We had friends in common, but I was not really aware of him at that stage of my life. Many years later, after I left Kinsale, I began to immerse myself in his poetry, and like many before me, became entranced by the disused shed. Some encounters are unusual only in their timing. I had to leave Kinsale and wait my turn in the time-space continuum. By an unexpected coincidence, in my professional capacity as an art dealer in Dublin, I began to show the work of artist Sarah Eiermonger, Derek Mahon's partner, and met Derek during the last 2 years of his life. Sarah's meticulously executed abstractions inevitably took on Derek's presence, and his later poems drew on her practice. When I visited Derek in his ground floor flat in the Grove, Kinsale, I immediately spotted his typewriter, the poet's enigma machine, breaking the codes for the mystery of love, lost and recollected, perched on a desk in front of the picture window, the light of the universe entering his working mind with carefully annotated books on every subject surrounding him. He was happy that, in his words, I knew my way around the poems. I asked him about the disused shed. I was especially curious about the line, "Lost people of Treblinka and Pompeii, save us, they seem to say." Treblinka is not a household name, the single most efficient death camp of the Holocaust. It devoured some 850,000 Jews in 18 months, including 90% of the Warsaw Ghetto in 1942 and 43. My father's family were murdered there, about 100 souls, erased from the world. We do not even know their names. Deportees to the camps had to pay for their own terminal train ride. The SS, who devised and ran the final solution, had no budget from the treasury in Berlin, so it was financed by what was seized from the victims. Train fares were purchased from the Reichsbahn, the German railway, one-way tourist tickets in bulk to economise. This calculation had been made by the same civil servants who ensured that water came out of taps, that streets were lit at night, and that schools were heated in winter. Functionaries dutifully carrying out government policy. The young and the old focused on the logistical challenge, the systematic destruction of their neighbours, whole communities, the young and the old. Lost people of Treblinka, lost people of Pompeii. The poet references human disasters, man-made and natural, but why did the poet not choose Auschwitz, the one name more than any other which evokes the Holocaust? I asked him. Oh, he said dismissively, but with no hint of unkindness. Scansion, most probably. I understood immediately not to trouble him further and let the poet speak through his poem.
Happiness, in memory of Mary Lavin. You're making this old crock shake, like a bird on the hover dipping a wing. You drop one shoulder, twist the handlebars, turn at last into a quiet triangular place. This park, you've been on a mission to reach. Inside its railings, the great trees are ready. They spread their branches, filter light onto the sculpture's shiny silver curves. Please refrain from touching or climbing on this. So dip the other wing and swing through the gates, break to a halt. Glitter of the slowing spokes, you dismount from joy, crunch past the fountain and out towards Lad Lane. Look right, she's there, standing behind the office's tall glass, staring at you with those same half-smiling eyes that met the camera's gaze decades ago. This photo I've cycled here to view. Writer who knew all about bicycles. The widow's son racing down the hill, wind in his hair, scholarship in his heart, who swerves, flies over handlebars to an early death. Why did he put the price of an old clucking hen above the price of his own life? Writer, caught in black and white, her arms flung across the mantelpiece, the rough muse wall, her backdrop. Hand-knit cardigan, her warmth, tweed skirt, her practical garb. But the medallion is a giveaway. Artful sun that circles back to now, to this ancient light. To the bicycle flung aside, the coach house door opening to reveal her. She's thrown coffee beans on the hob minutes before, filling the dining room air with a whiff of elsewhere. Piazza Navona, Boulevard Saint-Michel. She pulls the pins from her messy bun, lets her long grey hair down. The pendant light swings above. Wine flows and the table is forever round.
On this morning's programme, we heard George and Harry by Rosalind Dee, The Great Liberty's Whiskey Fire by Laz Fallon, Omnia Vanitas was by Sharon Hogan, Blethering by John Toole, Meeting the Poet by Oliver Sears, and Happiness, a poem by Enda Wiley. The music was Georgie Boy by Jack L, Fire and Rain by James Taylor, Veni Veni Emmanuel sung by the King's Sisters, Over the Rainbow
performed by Israel Kamakavi Vole, and Nocturne No. 20 in C-sharp minor by Chopin, played by Angela Hewitt. And some books you may be interested in. The Great Liberties Whiskey Fire by Laz Fallon is published by Wordwell Books. Sudden Light is Enda Wiley's latest poetry collection, and it's published by Daedalus Press. And a reminder as well that there's a new Sunday Miscellany anthology out. Sunday Miscellany, a selection from 2023 to 2025, and it's published by New Island Books. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this programme on the RTE Radio 1 player or on all usual podcast platforms.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.